Donald Trump is in the Epstein files thousands and thousands of times. In those files, there's highly disturbing allegations of Donald Trump raping children, of Donald Trump threatening to kill children. So I encourage your press to go look at these allegations.
Okay. We will, Congressman Ted Lieu. Good advice.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
That's one reason.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
No, it ain't.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
I am. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is The Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in L.A. Also in California, in Red Bluff and Redding on KFOI and Round Mountains KKRN. Up in Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, Cottage Grove's KSO, Eugene's KEPW. Lanchester, Pennsylvania's W News, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU, in Columbus, Ohio on WGRN, Palinville, New York's WLPP, Rochester, New York's WRFZ, down in New Orleans, Happy Mardi Gras, on WHIV, out in Gallup, New Mexico on KNIZ, Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN, Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ, in Seattle on KODX, Richmond, Virginia's WRWK, Fairmont, West Virginia's WEFR, Janesville, Wisconsin's WADR, and Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM 950 KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day on the internets and the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Radio for Humans, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, No Lies Radio, Detour Talk, Delmarva FM, and most of your favorite podcast sites blanketing planet Earth. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, all-around swell fellow, says me from BradBlog.com. Thank you very much for joining us, and welcome to your friendly neighborhood Bradcast. Delighted to have you here. I've got a lot to try and fit in today, including Desi Doyen with the latest Green News Report to close things out today.
Yeah.
Do you think we'll get there, Des?
Oh, we better.
We'll see. Anyway, let's get at it. Okay, so here is what a real country does. When you direct an insurrection against the government, doesn't matter if you are the sitting president or not, you get life in prison with hard labor. See, that was easy. Former South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol was found guilty of leading an insurrection on Thursday and sentenced to life in prison for his brief imposition of martial law back in 2024, a ruling that marks a dramatic culmination of the country's biggest political crisis in decades. The conservative leader was ousted from office after he had declared martial law, and he sent troops to surround the National Assembly on December 3rd of 2024 in a baffling attempt to overcome a legislature controlled by his liberal opponents. Ringing a bell for anyone out there by any chance? Judge Ji Kyu-yoon of the Seoul Central District Court said that he found Yoon, 65 years old, guilty of rebellion for mobilizing military and police forces in an illegal attempt to seize the assembly, arrest political opponents, and established unchecked power for an indefinite period. Yoon got off easy, in fact. After he was found guilty of these crimes, the judge had two choices, apparently: life in prison with hard labor or death. Well, Yoon got the former, even as prosecutors had sought the latter. So it's a pretty good deal, apparently. The unlawful martial law decree lasted only about 6 hours before being lifted after a quorum of lawmakers managed to break through a military blockade in order to get back into the parliament building, and they unanimously voted to lift the martial law measure. It was incredible at the time that it happened because it sort of came out of nowhere. I think it was just before we took air a couple of years ago when this happened in December of 2024. We covered it at the time. Yoon was suspended from office shortly thereafter December of 2024 after he was impeached by lawmakers. The court on Thursday also convicted and sentenced five former military and police officials involved in enforcing Yoon's martial law decree. They included the ex-defense minister, who received a 30-year jail time for his central role in planning the measure and instructing military counterintelligence officials to arrest 14 key politicians, including the National Assembly Speaker and the now current Liberal President Lee Jong-myung. In announcing the verdicts, the judge said, quote, "This court finds that the purpose of Yoon's action was to block the assembly building and arrest key figures in order to prevent lawmakers from gathering to deliberate or vote. It's sufficiently established," the judge said, "that he intended to obstruct or paralyze the assembly's activities so that it would be unable to properly perform its functions." Again, sounding familiar yet by any chance? Last month, Yoon was also sentenced to 5 years in prison for resisting arrest, fabricating the martial law proclamation, and sidestepping a legally mandated full cabinet meeting before declaring the measure. The leader of the Liberal Democratic Party, which led the push to impeach and remove Yoon, expressed regret that the court stopped short of the death penalty.
Wow.
Saying the ruling reflected a, quote, "lack of a sense of justice." Yikes. I guess they take the law and order pretty seriously in South Korea.
Wonder what that's like.
Yoon is the first former South Korean president to receive a life sentence since former military dictator Chun Doo-hwan was sentenced to death himself in 1996 for his 1979 coup, a bloody 1980 crackdown on progressive, on pro-democracy protesters that left more than 200 people dead or missing, and for corruption. Overnight, South Korea became the second country in the past 6 months to sentence a former head of state to a stiff prison sentence for leading an attempted coup, notes TPM's David Kurtz today. It took just 14 months for South Korea to mete out justice for subverting the country's constitution. In Brazil, meanwhile, it took 33 months from Donald Trump ally Jair Bolsonaro's January 2023 attempt to overturn his election loss through force with an attack on the parliament building by his supporters until he was finally convicted for the crime. Bolsonaro is now serving a 27-year prison sentence. In our country, of course, thanks to the corrupted U.S. Supreme Court, presidents are allowed to commit any and all crimes that they want with impunity, including a violent attempt to overthrow the U.S. government itself by force, by inciting an insurrection. As a bipartisan 57-43 majority of the U.S. Senate determined that, yes, Donald Trump was in fact guilty of doing at the end of his second impeachment trial. He, unlike what happened in Brazil, unlike what happened overnight in South Korea, he would be allowed to become the president again just 4 years later after receiving zero penalties for one of the most notorious crimes in U.S. history. South Korea's disgraced former president was not the only high-ranking, seemingly untouchable state official to face accountability overnight, however, at least in real countries, which are not the United States. The former Prince Andrew was arrested by British police on Thursday on suspicion of misconduct in public office related to his links to pedophile sex trafficker and longtime best friend of Donald Trump, Jeffrey Epstein. An extraordinary move, as AP reports, in a country where authorities once sought to shield the royal family from embarrassment. It was the first time in nearly four centuries that a senior British royal was placed under arrest. King Charles III issued a statement on the arrest of his brother, formerly known as Prince Andrew, now known as Andrew Mountbatten Windsor, saying, quote, "Let me state clearly, the law must take its course," the king said. "As this process continues, it would not be right for me to comment further on this matter." The Thames Valley Police Force, which covers areas west of London, including where the former prince was living, said Thursday only that a man in his 60s, who is from Norfolk in eastern England, has been arrested and was in custody.
Norfolk man arrested.
That's right. Didn't take long to figure out who he was. Police previously said that they were, quote, assessing reports that the 66-year-old disgraced former prince sent trade information to Epstein in 2010 when the former prince was Britain's special envoy for international trade. Correspondence between the two men was released by the U.S. Justice Department late last month, along with millions of pages of documents from the American investigation into Jeffrey Epstein. Quote, "This is the most spectacular fall from grace for a member of the royal family in modern times," said Craig Prescott, a royal expert at the University of London. Now, the last time that, and he's not kidding, when he talks about, you know, the first time in modern times, the last time a senior British royal was arrested was almost 400 years ago during the reign of King Charles I. That saw a growing power struggle between the crown and the parliament at the time, after the king attempted to arrest lawmakers in the House of Commons in 1642, hostilities erupted into the English Civil War, which ended with victory for the parliamentary forces of Oliver Cromwell. Charles I was then arrested, tried, convicted of high treason, and beheaded in 1649.
Wow.
So, yeah, it kind of seems like history really frowns on both insurrectionists, I guess, and, for that matter, pedophiles, at least in real countries. Mountbatten Windsor has consistently denied any wrongdoing in his association with Epstein. However, the allegations being investigated Thursday are actually separate from those made by Virginia Giuffre, who claimed that she was trafficked to Britain in order to have sex with the prince back in 2001 when she was just 17 years old. She died by suicide last year. Still, Giuffre's family praised the arrest of Andrew, saying that their, quote, "broken hearts have been lifted at the news that no one is above the law, not even royalty." Well, at least not in real countries that are not the U.S. As writer Julian Sanchez, known as Normative on Blue Sky, quipped on Thursday morning, quote, "So SCOTUS, with its fabricated out of thin air immunity doctrine, has actually made American presidents less accountable than literal royalty." Yep, sure has. Links to Epstein have dogged the royal family for more than a decade now. Since October of last year, Charles has stripped his younger brother of the right to be called prince, forced him to move out of the royal estate that he had occupied for more than 20 years, and issued a public statement supporting the women and girls abused by Jeffrey Epstein. Last week, the palace said that it was ready to cooperate with police investigating Mountbatten Windsor. Charles was forced to act after Andrew's correspondence with Epstein, released by the DOJ, thanks to the Epstein Transparency Act forced through Congress by Democrats. After that, torpedoed the former prince's claims that he had severed ties with Epstein after his 2008 conviction for soliciting a minor for prostitution. Instead, emails between the two men show Epstein offering to arrange a date between Andrew and a young Russian woman back in 2010, and then the then prince inviting Epstein to dinner at Buckingham Palace. Kind of like when Lutnick, Howard Lutnick, Donald Trump's Commerce Department chair, claim that, he met Epstein once, thought he was disgusting, never wanted to be in a room with him again. And then only later, thanks to the release of these documents, we find out, he met him. He was driving around in his yacht and said, hey, why don't I come over for lunch, Jeffrey, on your private island?
Surprise.
The longest the former prince could be held was for 96 hours. That would have required multiple extensions from officials following his arrest at 8 a.m. in Great Britain. He was to be placed in, quote, a cell in a custody suite with just a bed and a toilet, where he would await his police interview. An expert on law enforcement in the UK said that there'll be no special treatment for him. Andrew was released later in the day, but remains under investigation, according to British law enforcement official. But Andrew is not the only high-ranking official in Britain to face consequences for his relationship with Donald Trump's longtime best friend. Peter Mandelson, the fired UK ambassador to the United States, is under investigation for allegedly passing on market-sensitive government information to Epstein. Two of his properties were searched by police earlier this month following the release of documents. And within days of the news of the criminal investigation, Prime Minister Keir Starmer's chief of staff, Morgan McSweeney, resigned, taking responsibility for Starmer's 2024 appointment of Mandelson as ambassador, and Starmer himself now under fire because of all of this. In Norway, former Prime Minister Thorbjørn Jagland, was charged last week with, quote, gross corruption over his ties to Jeffrey Epstein. His arrest and the search of three of his properties came only after the Council of Europe revoked his diplomatic immunity. The married diplomats Mona Juul and Terry Rode Larsen are also under investigation in Norway for, quote, aggravated corruption, whatever that means, for their dealings with Epstein. In both cases, the alleged corruption did not involve child sex trafficking, but allegations of financial benefits from Epstein. Juul was suspended and then resigned earlier this month as Norway's ambassador to Jordan and Iraq. So real consequences, real accountability in real countries, just not in the U.S. and in France. Former culture minister Jack Lang and his daughter are under criminal investigation for the Epstein ties through an offshore company in the U.S. Virgin Islands, while the French foreign minister launched a separate administrative investigation of senior French diplomat Fabrice Adan amid allegations that while he worked at the United Nations, he shared diplomatic documents with Jeffrey Epstein. So all over the world, people are paying the price for their relationship with Jeffrey Epstein. And yet here in the United States, where the president of the United States was actually best friend for years and years with Jeffrey Epstein, acknowledged years ago that, he had a lot in common with Epstein, and that he knew, in fact, that Epstein liked girls on the younger side, I think is what he told New York in that year 2000 interview. Well, back here, we're still fighting for accountability, any accountability, because the president of the United States also controls the Department of Justice, which not only has not been trying to hold him accountable, has actually been helping him to avoid accountability, has actually been helping him to cover up the real extent of what is in those files. And the allegations regarding Donald Trump are far, far worse than, you know, simply sharing market-sensitive economic government information with him. Far worse. In a story that I promise you I would not be covering, I would not be reporting on at all at this time, were it not for the fact that the DOJ is actively attempting to hide this information from you. in strict violation of the Epstein Transparency Act, which is very clear about this. This story, investigative journalist Roger Sullenberger of the Daily Beast reported at his Substack newsletter on Sunday that the FBI had interviewed a victim of Jeffrey Epstein's who had accused President Donald Trump of sexually and violently assaulting her when she was between the ages of 13 and 15 years old. Sullenberger also reported that some of the Justice Department's case files for this woman, who later sued and reportedly received a settlement from Jeffrey Epstein's estate for sexual abuse allegations in the during the same time frame, some of those documents appear to be missing from the government's publicly searchable Epstein database. And I believe that this is the matter that Congressman Ted Lieu of California, a former prosecutor himself, I think this is what he was referencing when he made these remarks to the media, I believe, at the U.S. Capitol earlier this month in advance of House Republicans calling in Bill and Hillary Clinton into Congress for their testimony against Jeffrey Epstein.
So why are Republicans so interested in Bill and Hillary Clinton? It's because they're trying to distract from the fact that Donald Trump is in the Epstein files thousands and thousands of times. In those files, there's highly disturbing allegations of Donald Trump raping children, of Donald Trump threatening to kill children. So I encourage your press to go look at these allegations, and I'm highly disturbed that Deputy Attorney General Todd Blanche just got the law wrong. Yesterday, he said essentially that it is not a crime to party with Jeffrey Epstein. Well, that's actually not correct. If Jeffrey Epstein was human trafficking minors for these sex parties, and you show up and patronize the establishment at that party, yes, you're guilty, because patronizing is part of the law, the federal sex trafficking law. So Deputy General Todd Blanche just got that wrong, which maybe explains why they aren't investigating all these folks, including Donald Trump.
Well, that's one reason they're not investigating all of these folks, including Donald Trump. And I doubt it's because Todd Blanche, Donald Trump's own personal criminal defense lawyer, who is now serving as the deputy attorney general. I think he's got a whole bunch more reasons to not be investigating any of this. So,
yeah.
Thankfully, there are guys like Sullenberger digging through these documents, trying to make sense of them and trying to figure out which documents are supposed to be there but are not, like this document regarding the FBI interview with this victim who was paid off essentially by the Jeffrey Epstein estate and who has made startling allegations against Donald Trump. As Sullenberger reported last night, that he has found DOJ records showing that the FBI did not just interview this woman once, in fact, but he has discovered that the FBI interviewed this woman who claimed that, and claimed that Trump forced her to give him oral sex when she was in her early teens and then punched her in the head after she, let's just say, bit him, and then he kicked her out, threatened her, and so forth. But the FBI apparently interviewed this woman at least four times. But the DOJ's file associated with those records, a document cataloging information that the government provided the counsel for convicted Epstein co-conspirator Ghislaine Maxwell during her trial, has apparently been removed. That's just one of the documents that seems to have been removed. This document that they made available to Maxwell when she was going through her trial to say, well, we have these documents available for you. And they referenced these interviews with the FBI by this woman. This revelation, Sullenberg reports, adds to the mounting pile of evidence undermining statements from Trump's corrupted Attorney General Pam Bondi and other senior administration officials assuring the public that the Epstein file release has been transparent, complete, and bereft of any evidence implicating Trump in wrongdoing in any way, which he's been running around saying that he's been 100% exonerated by these files. Sullenberger explains that his reporting showed that the FBI found this woman's allegations credible enough, apparently, to warrant a formal interview, which she gave with her attorney present at the interview in July of 2019. And now, as he says he has just learned, credible enough for three additional interviews. The woman's attorney reportedly told agents in that first interview that she would only speak to them at the time about Epstein and not any other people, including by name Donald Trump, specifying that the reason was a, quote, fear of retaliation. Now, Sullenberger points out credible does not mean the woman's claims were actually verified or even that they could be independently verified, which her initial interview suggests may be impossible since she did not memorialize the abuse in writing at the time when it happened to her as early as the age of 13. And again, I will repeat, I am reporting on this only because the DOJ is apparently attempting to cover up these documents that they are legally mandated to have produced already, but that they are apparently covering up by not releasing, even as they are falsely claiming that they have released all of the files that they are required to release under law. That is clearly a lie. Specifically, they're supposed to release all of their documents related to the years-long Jeffrey Epstein probe in any way, including the Ghislaine Maxwell probe, with only the identifying information of victims redacted. Under the statute, they may not withhold information or redact the names about anybody else due to, you know, the possibility of public embarrassment, etc. That's just unlawful under the statute. As Sullenberger notes, the four interviews with this person alleging these crimes doesn't mean that the DOJ believed it could seek charges because of her claims alone, especially since they'd need to hear her. They'd need to her to cooperate as a witness if they did want to bring charges, something that she clearly made clear she didn't want to do out of fear of retaliation. He notes we don't even know if the DOJ arrived at any final disposition regarding this woman's allegations against the president. It just means that the FBI found her to be credible in 2019 during Trump's first presidency and 6 years later included her allegation as a bullet point in this comprehensive internal presentation about the Epstein and Maxwell case history that was assembled last summer, but is appearing to withhold the documentation of those interviews, according to Sullenberger. Make sense?
Yes, that the documents were there. Now they've been withheld.
His digging through the documents also reveals that the four interviews took place in the summer of 2019. One of them was in October of that year, following Epstein's second arrest that same year. The document referencing those files also accounts for FBI interview notes, quote, interview notes that are associated with three of the four interviews. And he posts a screenshot of the index file pointing to those interviews. The only reason that the public can see that screenshot today, he notes, is because in late January, this Epstein database document happened to get saved at the Internet Wayback Machine, the web page archiving service. Otherwise, while it was previously available, apparently it is no longer available, nor are the documents that it references. So it's sort of a reference to the documents that they have available.
Like an index.
And that index is now gone. Luckily, it was saved by the Wayback Machine, and the documents that it refers to either were never posted or are now gone as well. Thanks to the Internet Archive, he notes, the document does live on. document that the DOJ gave to Ghislaine Maxwell as part of their criminal case against her. Essentially, you know, informing her, as the DOJ is required to do, of, you know, what the available evidence is related to her case so that she could request it if she wants to use it for her defense in some fashion. But beyond the copy in the Internet archives that Sullenberger found, the DOJ apparently no longer allows the public to see this document despite the Epstein Files Transparency Act. The Trump Epstein accusers' allegations cover the period from roughly 1983 to 1985. Sullenberger notes the interview timeline raises significant questions for Trump, his White House mouthpieces, and his hand-picked leaders at DOJ, including Attorney General Pam Bondi, FBI Director Kash Patel, Deputy Attorney General and former Trump criminal defense lawyer Todd Blanche, and former Deputy FBI Director Dan Bongino, among others. All of these officials, notes Sullenberger, have sought to distance and downplay Donald Trump's ties to the dead child predator, sometimes with unabashed, obvious lies and gleeful defiance. Before joining the Trump administration, Bondi, Patel, and Bongino had all advocated for the full release of the Epstein materials. They were all in favor of that back when somehow they thought this was going to, I don't know, expose Bill Clinton or something. Despite the fact that all the videos and all the comments and all the quotes out there about Jeffrey Epstein come from Donald Trump. The videos of them partying together, somehow they all thought, oh, this is going to really hurt Democrats. Okay, whatever.
Well, I think they actually never intended to release them. They thought that they could promise all these things and then nobody would remember that they did.
Well, they promised all these things. They called for all of these things. Donald Trump even called for these things while he was running for president.
With
knowing,
no intention.
Well, yeah. And then he was forced. Well, they're trying to force him to do it. Obviously,
yes.
He has been able to cover up the most, perhaps most damning evidence of all in those files about him. So everywhere around the world, other than in the U.S., even high-ranking officials, even royalty, which has not faced criminal accountability for literally centuries, all around the world, people are being held to account for attempted insurrections and for relationships to Jeffrey Epstein, but not here in the U.S., where we had a president of the United States found guilty by the U.S. Senate of having incited an insurrection, who faced multiple criminal charges related to it, and who was best friends with Jeffrey Epstein for years. And now we've made him president again, because only here is there no accountability. At least not yet. But we'll see, because we'll keep watching all of this. And now we know these documents exist. And I see no reason to believe that this, no matter what they say, no matter what Pam Bondi says, no matter what Todd Blanche says, oh, we've released them all, or the release of the files is complete. No, it is not, because we know these files exist and they have not been released. But there is at least one more very intriguing element to Roger Sullenberger's report on Wednesday on this alleged 13-year-old rape victim of Donald Trump's. And we will touch on that right after a quick break. I'm Brad Friedman, and you are listening to The Bradcast.
The Bradcast and the Green News Report are 100% independent, 100% listener supported. But we can't do it alone. We need you. Please help us bring real facts to listeners at independent stations around the nation. Please drop by bradblog.com/donate. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
Are you still talking about Jeffrey Epstein?
Yes.
This guy's been talked about for years. Mm. And are people still talking about this guy, this creep?
Yeah.
That is unbelievable.
Is it? Is it unbelievable? You know, maybe we wouldn't be talking about it had you not been trying to cover it up. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. We're talking about it today only because it looks like y'all have covered up very specific and disturbing allegations against the man who is now president of the United States, who would like us very much not to be talking about it. But the fact that we are talking about it, it's kind of the Streisand effect, isn't it?
Yeah.
Where, not unlike what we saw earlier in the week, when CBS, scared of Donald Trump's FCC, made Stephen Colbert take his interview with U.S. Senate candidate in Texas, James Tallarico, wouldn't allow them to air it, claiming equal time laws prevented them from being able to do so. So ended up, Stephen Colbert told everyone about that, said, okay, fine, we'll interview Tallarico and post it only to our YouTube page, which is not regulated by the FCC in any way, shape, or form. And guess what? I just checked it. 7.8 million people have seen Stephen Colbert's interview with James Tallarico over on the YouTube page. Colbert only gets about 2.5 million viewers a night.
Total.
So like three times as many people have now seen this interview with James Tallarico because the Trump administration essentially was trying to hide it.
Yes, and by trying to hide it, they called attention to it.
Yes.
That's why it's called the Streisand effect. It refers to a time when Barbara Streisand tried to squash a story, and by squashing it, she actually caused it to go way more viral than it
Correct.
Would have otherwise if she'd just shut up about it.
Correct. And in the meantime, by the way, I feel sorry for Tallarico, who is running in the March 3rd primary down in Texas against for the U.S. Senate nomination against Congresswoman Jasmine Crockett, who has not gotten the same attention out of this that Tallarico has. And also, I should note, a man named Ahmad Hassan is also running for that nomination. And it's because it's a three-way race. That means right now, most of the polls say
for the Democratic primary.
In the Democratic primary, most of the polls say that Tallarico and Crockett are pretty much running neck and neck at this point, or at least they were before all of this Colbert stuff. At about 41% apiece, if neither of them gets more than 50%, there will be a runoff for that nomination in May, I believe it is.
So guess we should call it the Streisand backfire effect.
Yeah, exactly. Or the Tallarico effect, or now the Donald Trump Jeffrey Epstein effect. We're picking up on this report last night from investigative journalist Roger Sullenberger, who has been deep diving into the Epstein documents for many, many months now, doing a fantastic job. This regards his report on Wednesday on an allegation, just an allegation, mind you, by an alleged victim of Jeffrey Epstein's, who said that she was abused by Epstein between the ages of 13 to 15, and that she was raped and physically punched and threatened by Donald Trump when she was 13 years old. Now, the Epstein estate settled with this accuser for an undisclosed amount, and she reportedly only agreed to speak to the FBI about all of this in 2019 if she was only to be asked about Jeffrey Epstein because of her, quote, fear of retaliation by the then sitting president, that according to the now woman's attorney at the time. Sullenberger discovered, thanks to a DOJ document that indexed a whole bunch of evidence to be made available to Epstein accomplice Ghislaine Maxwell in her trial, that the FBI didn't interview this woman only once, as had previously been reported, but seemingly found her allegations credible enough that she was interviewed four times by the FBI, with three of those interviews accompanied by what are described on this index page as FBI interview notes. That page has since disappeared, but Sullenberger was able to find it on the Internet Archives. It was seemingly removed by the DOJ from the DOJ website. The URL for it now says document not found if you try to go to where it is supposed to be. And if I'm understanding the story correctly, either all or at least the last three interviews with the woman have not been posted at all. Again, in strict violation of the Epstein Transparency Act, which requires the release of all documents related to either the Epstein or Maxwell cases. So Sullenberger notes, another question or two that he notes in his report from Wednesday night. He notes that on February 27 of last year, 2025, about a month after Donald Trump had taken office for the second time, his attorney general, Pam Bondi, made a big public to-do on Fox News, claiming that she and FBI Director Kash Patel had just been, quote, surprised, unquote, to learn that the FBI had, quote, thousands of pages of evidence in the Epstein case that they had not turned over to her, despite the Bureau's assurances that they had provided all the available documents. She sent a letter to Patel at the time, ordering him to get to the bottom of whatever happened. I'm sure he'll get right on that. and to deliver a report to her about his findings in 2 weeks. Sullenberger notes that we don't know what happened to that report, but the very next day after she made that big to-do with Fox News, Sullenberger noticed the DOJ returned to Donald Trump troves of sensitive government documents that he had taken with him to Mar-a-Lago upon leaving office back in 2021. Yes, those documents, the ones that he stole from the White House upon leaving office the first time, supposedly highly sensitive national security documents that he was not allowed to take and that he refused to give back despite repeated gentle requests and then warnings that he was violating the law, et cetera, and for which he was eventually charged with, I believe it was 4 felony violations in an indictment by Special Counsel Jack Smith. An indictment that would eventually be dismissed after Trump won the presidency for a second time because the DOJ has long ago determined that a sitting president can't face criminal charges while serving in office, and our U.S. Supreme Court, in all of its infamous corruption, has determined that presidents may not be charged for anything, by and large, that they do while serving as president. The presidential immunity doctrine that does not exist in the Constitution, but the Supreme Court, 3 of the members selected by Donald Trump himself, pretend that it does exist. But after returning to office the second time, the DOJ actually gave Donald Trump back those stolen files that they had obtained during the raid down at Mar-a-Lago to take those government files back.
I mean, I'm still kind of blown away by the they gave those stolen documents back to him.
Well, because they were property of the U.S. and as president, he has, while president, he gets to have access to those documents. So the White House at the time, notes Sullenberger, would not confirm whether Trump took all of the documents back or not, or whether he allowed the government to retain some of them. I mean, these were cases and cases, boxes and boxes of documents, tens of thousands of them. So are documents related to this matter that we are talking about regarding Jeffrey Epstein, regarding this interview with this woman who claims that when she was 13, she was raped and physically abused by Donald Trump? Are documents related to that matter among those that Donald Trump stole upon leaving office, leaving the White House the first time and refused thereafter, despite repeated warnings and, the clear penalty of criminal law that he would not give back to the government? Are these among those files? Don't know. But that would certainly explain a few things, if so, about why he was so desperate to not give those files back, even facing a criminal indictment if he did not. Now, Sullenberger notes that a master Epstein evidence manifest shows that the government, quote, acquired at least four pieces of Epstein evidence somehow in late February and March of last year. The first is dated as, quote, acquired on February 27. That is the day that Bondi went public about the additional files that she says she did not know about and ordered Patel to investigate. The other three are dated March 10, as the DOJ was carrying out its five-alarm, all-hands Epstein files review, as Sullenberger describes it, and reportedly scrambling to find and flag all of the references in them to Donald Trump. So are any of those dates or documents related to this Trump accuser? Sullenberger offered in his newsletter one last note about those FBI interviews with her. He says, as I reported on Sunday, her initial interview, the one that has been publicly released and is still accessible, was conducted July 24, 2019. It then entered the FBI's case files on August 9, which turns out to be the day before Jeffrey Epstein was found dead in his jail cell. Okay.
Huh. I'm sorry. Say that one more time.
Well, she
just
was
want to make sure I have that cemented.
Well, she was interviewed on July 24, 2019, and then she is officially, that interview is put into the case files on August 9. The next day, Jeffrey Epstein was found dead. Now, he notes that FBI agents typically have a deadline of 5 working days to file their field interview write-ups. So they have a field interview with her. They have 5 days to put it into the record. This was actually a 16-day gap, not 5 days, but 16 days for some reason between the interview and the time that it shows up in the FBI case record. Why?
Huh.
I don't know. But I thought you should know about it. Sullenberger notes this new material, the new material that he has discovered, not just that one interview, but the 4 interviews they've done with her, that interview, that material that is no longer accessible on the DOJ website shows that the woman's other formal interviews took place August 7, August 20, and October 16. That means, he notes, she spoke to the FBI 2 days before her first interview had even been entered into the case file. And 3 days before Epstein was found dead in his prison cell. The fourth interview on October 16 of 2019, after Epstein had already died several months earlier, is the only one that is not accompanied by additional FBI interview notes in the Maxwell evidence record made available for her use during her trial. Why is that last one has no FBI interview notes with it? Yeah, I don't know, but I thought you should know. As noted, I would not be covering any of this at all, I suspect. These salacious and very disturbing allegations, and that's all they are at this time, is allegations against Trump that he essentially raped and physically assaulted a minor who might have been 13 at the time. If these allegations are true, they are merely allegations. Anyone can make them. Whether they can be made as specifically and apparently credibly enough to result in 4 interviews with the FBI, total, you know, 1 interview followed by 3 more that we're only learning, just now learning about, well, that's a different matter, I suspect. But of course, we don't know the substance of those interviews because why? Well, the DOJ is hiding them from us in defiance of the law. And because they think that it's worth violating the law in order to keep you from knowing about them, I think you should know about them. And now you do. And you should also know that while there's a whole bunch of stuff in those files that we've been seeing over, you know, the past weeks, months at this point, millions of documents, including millions that have not yet been released at all, to my knowledge, the DOJ will not have complied with the law until all of these documents with the allegations from this woman, credible or not, until those documents are released to the public so we can investigate the claims, even if DOJ does not seem interested in doing so. They will not have met the rule of law. The cover-up will continue until we get to see the documents from all four of those FBI interviews, whether she was telling the truth or not. So if all of this cover-up is meant to hide those documents, well, at least you know they exist and that you can be on the lookout for them. And until then, you can know that Donald Trump and his DOJ are, yes, violating the law. Lock them up. Green News Report is next. I'm Brad Friedman. You're listening to the Bradcast. Hey, this is Brad. Please consider supporting whichever progressive media outlet is supporting you and the things that you care about. Most, just like us, do not receive corporate or political support. We all need your support to counter the powerful corporate media echo chamber. Right now, as much as ever. If you choose to support us, you can do it really easily, safely, and quickly via bradblog.com/donate. From Desi Doyen and myself, thank you. All right. And now for something completely different. somewhat different. Let's get to it. Our latest Green News Report.
After two decades of scientific evidence supporting the 2009 finding, the agency cannot credibly claim that that body of work is now incorrect.
Environmental and public health groups sue Trump EPA over repeal of the endangerment finding. New data suggests the rate of man-made global warming could be accelerating. Plus, the Trump administration has effectively canceled enforcement of environmental laws.
All of that Trump administration cancel culture and more straight ahead from bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
I mean, there's a lot of science here,
yes,
and everything else, but those issues do impact all of us.
Even with all that science? This is your Green News Report. I'm gonna soak up the sun. Okay, Desi Doyen, we saw this coming from miles away when they overturned the endangerment finding, but let the court battles begin.
Yes, the epic court battle is now underway. A broad coalition of public health and environmental groups sued the Trump administration on Wednesday over the Environmental Protection Agency's repeal of the landmark endangerment finding. That is the scientific determination that greenhouse gas emissions from burning oil, gas, and coal endanger public health by causing destructive climate change. It was the legal underpinning for U.S. climate pollution regulations. The federal lawsuit also challenges the EPA's rollback of fuel economy rules and tailpipe emission regulations for cars and trucks, the nation's largest source of climate pollution. Veteran climate scientist Dr. Michael Mann on the Midas Touch Network warned that the stakes could not be higher.
We will lock in far more devastating consequences for our health, for national security, for our economy, certainly. The cost of climate inaction is far greater than any cost of taking action. And so, yes, the elimination of the endangerment finding and its the limit that that places on the U.S. and its ability to regulate carbon emissions could have global ramifications because we are the world's largest legacy polluter.
And now new data suggests that the rate of global warming may be accelerating.
Great.
Global warming previously proceeded at a fairly steady rate, but a new Washington Post analysis finds that the last 30 years are the fastest warming period since record keeping began in the mid-1800s.
And that's why we need to shut down the Washington Post.
Well, the Washington Post also reports that the rate of global warming has also ticked up further in just the last 10 years. In a different study, an international team of scientists determined that the planet today is heating up faster than at any time in the last 3 million years. The researchers warn that humanity's ongoing greenhouse gas emissions risk tipping parts of the climate system into a series of self-reinforcing feedbacks, potentially committing the planet to substantially higher temperatures long term.
Meanwhile, back here in this country, we've done away with all the climate regulations.
And the Trump EPA's killing of the endangerment finding caps a year of deregulation that has killed off rules intended to curb industrial pollution of air, water, and soil. According to a report by nonprofit watchdog group Environmental Integrity Project, the EPA's enforcement of the remaining environmental and pollution regulations has nearly collapsed in the second Trump term.
Mm-hmm.
The Trump administration has also taken numerous actions to prop up the dying coal industry. Earlier this month, the EPA delayed a deadline for coal plants to clean up their toxic coal ash disposal sites across the country that are leaking toxins into groundwater.
No rush.
Reuters reports that the EPA also plans to loosen restrictions on coal-burning power plants, allowing them to emit more pollutants, including hazardous toxic mercury.
Fantastic.
Mercury is a powerful neurotoxin that harms brain development in babies and children. Studies have directly tied mercury pollution from coal plants to the mercury contamination in nearly all U.S. waterways and fish.
Well, let's see if we can get those studies revoked as well.
Conservation organizations and an Alaskan tribe this week sued over the Trump administration's renewed push for oil and gas development in the National Petroleum Reserve in Alaska, ecologically sensitive lands that were previously protected habitat for wildlife. Finally, a coalition of scientific and historical groups this week sued the Trump administration over its efforts to whitewash history at multiple national parks, arguing that the administration's removal of factual information about climate change, civil rights, and more amounts to illegal censorship.
Facts. Who needs them? For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Find, follow, and share us planet-wide on the social medias, especially Blue Sky at Green News Report. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
Make the world go away.
Yeah, make it go away. You know, that sign on Donald Trump's door that says Donald J. Trump, 47th President of the United States. If we just take that sign down, does that mean he is no longer the president?
I wish it were that easy.
Apparently they think it is. Anyway, thank you very much, Desiree, our producer. And thanks to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's program or any other since the beginning of time, you can download them all for free at bradblog.com. Why can you do that for free? Well, because a tiny little handful of you hit a donate button when you stop by to help us stay on your public airwaves. If we could turn that into a larger handful, that'd be great. Help us keep going. Or you can go straight to bradblog.com/donate. Drop me an email if you like. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com, and you'll find me on the social medias, especially Blue Sky at the Brad Blog. See you there. Until we see you here next time, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.